Rebels of Commonwealth Virginia.
Good afternoon, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, sir. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
5 minutes, please.
Yes, sir. You may begin when ready.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is James Delevich. I'm appearing on behalf of Joshua Ryan Bevels on appeal from convictions of distribution of a Schedule 1 or 2 controlled substance and a conspiracy of the same out of the Fredericksburg Circuit Court. We'd be asking the Court to consider our argument, reverse the finding of guilt, remand the case for a new trial. This argument's been granted on basically one issue. It was the introduction of what's called other crimes evidence prejudicial to Mr. Bevels such that it resulted in an unfair trial. As a criminal defense attorney, we write these motions a lot. Pull out the blurb on Roy v. Commonwealth, Kirkpatrick v. Commonwealth, and say that generally it's improper to introduce evidence of another crime. Preparing for the brief and preparing for this argument, I actually read hard and completely the Kirkpatrick decision and then some of the other decisions. And in there, I probably read it before, but was surprised by the fact that, you know, this is not just 20th century law, it's 19th century law. And the Walker case, we have a new Walker case referred to in the brief, but there's a very old Walker case from 1829 that has these general principles. And essentially, a sneaky prosecutor in 1829 sought to introduce during the larceny trial of a watch the evidence of a larceny trial of a coat. And the Court very simply said, no, that's not correct. But then there's a very long blurb by Justice Brokabaugh, and he talks about what we now know as the Kirkpatrick exceptions. And I guess they should be known as the Walker exceptions because they're basically the same, but a century older. And the exceptions are that there has to be a linkage between what is going on these separate offenses.
The evolution of prosecutors, I think, is referenced by what was said in the Farrell case. It's been said that there are so many exceptions to the rule that it's difficult to determine which is more extensive, the rule or its acknowledged exceptions. Which basically says that the Commonwealth can come up with any one of the, I think it's developed now, 9 or 10 exceptions to the rule, then they're okay as long as they make a sufficient proffer in the record as to why one of these exceptions would apply.
And I agree with that, and I think that's the particular problem in our case, is that prior to trial, the Commonwealth filed a written motion, and it indicated they want to introduce what wasn't prior unadjudicated bad act, but a subsequent act, another drug distribution from 2 days after the November 8th offense date. There was an argument by the court. The Commonwealth, in its argument, and the Attorney General in their reply brief talks about, maybe they had the wrong reason but got the right result. But her stated reason was common scheme or plan. So we'll talk about that for a second. And essentially, actually, let's not talk about that. We'll reverse that for a second. Because they said, well, even if it's not a common scheme or plan, then it must be something else. And in this instance, there's discussion about identity. There's a discussion about possibly knowledge or intent. And if applied to the particular facts of this case, and if you look at not only those exceptions, but I guess any other exceptions the Commonwealth could hope to try to employ or try to, I guess, buttress by introduction of the evidence, it is simply not applicable in this case. Identity is or knowledge, it could be addressed in facts like Kirkpatrick or Roy, where in Roy it's used to rebut, where he says, I don't know what a lottery book is, and then there's evidence of a prior conviction, which could be brought in, the court in that case said, properly. In Kirkpatrick, the guy says he doesn't know the guy who robbed the store, so they go back and build a timeline that includes other offenses, including a larceny from the day before, to build, I guess, the Commonwealth's knowledge, if you will, and by that, participation in the offense. The facts in this case are that a confidential informant said that she was speaking to Mr. Bevels on the phone. Mr. Bevels arranged a drug transaction, and on November 8th, at least, it anticipated he would be there, and when she arrived, it was someone else. It was his girlfriend. On the 8th, for November 10th, she said she was talking to Mr. Bevels, and during that conversation, Mr. Bevels said that he was going to eventually have his mom meet there, and that's, in fact, what happened. Stepping back, I guess, stripping away the November 10th for a second.
What about there's a number of cases that say this. One of them is Morton. It talks about the offense constitutes part of the general scheme of which the crime charge is also a part. And then the court goes on to say the general scheme exception is particularly appropriate where the accused is on trial for conspiracy, and here we have a conspiracy. So it seems like to me that might be one of the better arguments for...
Well, and then the judge raised that. I think his exact question is, scheme, isn't there a conspiracy charged here? But I would certainly argue that in this particular instance, there were two different co-conspirators. In other words, he was charged with, I guess, conspiracy ostensibly with Ms. Moore on the 8th, and the co-conspirator from the 10th would have been his mother. And so I would think that, they're number one, they're not linked that way. And I guess sometimes, by just throwing conspiracy in there, I don't think the Commonwealth does it with the intent to just kind of blow past these issues. But it, again, it does create, a commonality of action between the two parties. And in this particular instance, there just simply isn't a scheme. It really wasn't talked about at the trial, but I think from all the records, you can see that there were three actually charges against Mr. Bevels. One was actually him doing a hand-to-hand transaction. There was an acquittal on that. This one with a girlfriend, where they were expecting, him to be present, his girlfriend standing there, and another where apparently he's sent his mother instead. There simply doesn't appear to be the scheme that the Commonwealth alluded to. And I guess to jump back.
What would the scheme be to distribute drugs with these folks?
Well, that's where you get to, the common scheme or plan analysis under the Newwalker case. And these, obviously, this is not a joinder case, but I think the language of common scheme is exactly the same. An interesting fact in this case is that these cases were severed. There was a trial set for the November 10th offense, if you will, at some other time. They weren't joined to be tried, but the facts were certainly joined together, even if the charges themselves were set on separate offense dates. And even in those cases, Boyd, there I think it's talked about two transactions with the same officer not being a common scheme. And then there was a case after that, and the name escapes me at the moment, it was Walker. So there were four transactions, and they said that's not a common scheme. And the language there is essentially that these are drug offenses. There's no particular linkage between these offenses to show anything beyond that they're individual acts of someone to sell drugs to someone else. And it didn't really set out what the outer limit of that might be, if there's a number of transactions. But I would think in a case like this, where it's just street transactions, if you will, without a front or without identity type issues that might come up. In other words, I guess if in this case, the Commonwealth couldn't say with certainty who was on the phone on the 8th or something like that, there was no witness to say that, then perhaps you bring that in as to way to show knowledge or intent or identity, I guess more specifically. But the drug offenses as they're related really are no different than the hand-to-hand transactions to law enforcement that were discussed in these other cases. And frankly, in some ways, I think they're much less reliable, because one of the issues, obviously, is that the trial attorney sought to impeach the confidential informant about some prior involvement with a motorcycle and why she might be angry at him and things like that. Plus, she was a confidential informant for hire, where she was paid per buy. And, supporting that is the fact that Detective Pitt said he wasn't sure of the number that was called or, in fact, who she was talking to. He just relied on what she had to say. With regard to the girlfriend, here's a person on film handing over drugs to someone else. So when approached by law enforcement, it's not unbelievable or inherently incredible that she would blame somebody else, in this case her boyfriend. So what takes care of that a little bit, at least and obviously with some concern, is that the finder of fact, in this case the jury, hears about another transaction where maybe the principal, one of the principals, is different. It's not his girlfriend anymore, but his mother. But the guy behind it, the shadowy figure, is Mr. Bevels. And obviously, in case I forget to mention it, I can't imagine for one second that hearing that his mother is involved in his business didn't have a highly prejudicial effect on what the finder of fact thought about Mr. Bevels. That gets back to, the language of the opinion from 1829 to some degree. You can't forget, and it's been repeated in other cases, obviously, that the finder of fact, when considering these things, can't forget that this type of evidence is prejudicial. So like any evidence, you have to consider its probative nature, but when you talk about this type of evidence, it's probative versus prejudicial. And certainly, I would hope no one would disagree that it's prejudicial, but where is it probative? And if it's not going to show intent, if it's not going to show knowledge because he never denied it, it's not used for impeachment because he never got on the stand and said, I've never been involved in anything like this. It's not used for identity because both parties that testified on behalf of the Commonwealth were saying he's the guy, so it wasn't there to kind of support that proposition. than if you slip over to the common scheme or plan. And again, I would argue that that just simply doesn't meet muster as recent case law goes. And I was kind of surprised when I read Walker earlier in the spring, so that's great. But that decision's not necessarily new, nor is that rationale. I mean, I think Dunn and Boyd and some of those cases are years old now. But it's the same logic applied, that just the mere fact of multiple drug transactions absent something else don't allow joinder, or in this case I would argue don't allow inclusion as other crimes evidence. I'll preserve.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
May it please the court, Rosemary Bourne on behalf of the Commonwealth. First of all, we have to view this under the proper framework. And in this case, that's an abuse of discretion standard when we're talking about the admission of evidence. And so under that standard, if any reasonable jurist could have found that this was admissible under one of the exceptions, then this court should not reverse.
What is your best analytical framework for affirming a conviction, harmless error or adhering to the court's determination that the standards were met for common scheme or plan?
I would certainly not concede that it was not admissible under a common scheme or plan, and I'd like to address why. But certainly, if there was error in this case, it was harmless.
Isn't it sort of counterintuitive though? Because if in one instance, if we were to go to harmless error route, okay, that's almost counterintuitive to the common scheme of plan, because as I understand, common scheme of plan has to be idiosyncratic. And in this case, they're saying, well, this is what drug dealers do all the time in one context, and in another context, they're saying, well, it's unusual what this drug dealer did. So isn't it sort of counterintuitive if we were to look at both of them?
No, I mean, there are two arguments under the harmless error / waiver position. Mm-hmm. And, of course, some courts have talked about it as waiver, and some courts have talked about it as harmless error. But yeah, I think it falls under either framework. And that is that here, there was testimony from the girlfriend that this is what he does. I mean, she essentially said several things specifically that indicated that this happened on multiple occasions. And those were, that he leaves the drugs in a particular place, that, you know, someone will call him and then he'll tell me what to do, that these were transactions that occurred. There was no objection to any of that evidence. And so here again, this is under the common scheme or plan, in that he has other people distribute, actually take the drugs out to the person coming to get the drugs, even though he's the architect, if you will, of these transactions.
Would that make it idiosyncratic, though?
Well, it might make it idiosyncratic. I think it does make it idiosyncratic, but that doesn't mean that it's not harmless error. I guess I'm not understanding.
No. You're answering.
Okay.
You're answering.
So it is idiosyncratic, and the reason I think that it is under a common scheme or plan is because, although in these other cases, and there is a lot of authority that says just the mere fact of distributing drugs, for example, is not a common scheme or plan, just that if you've done it on a different occasion, even with the same person, that is not a common scheme or plan under the joinder rule specifically, and I think even under other bad acts, which, of course, I would note that this is a different standard. These are apples and oranges and not the same thing. Because this is other crimes, not joinder as Walker was. But in any event, if what we were talking about was only the fact that he had distributed drugs on other occasions to this particular person, I still might be able to get by on harmless error, but it would be a much tougher case. But in this case, what happened was that he had other people do this. And I think he argues a particular point that he says is helps him, but I actually think it helps our case. And that is the fact that the person identifying him is the informant. And what we know is that she's having these telephone calls with him. And what we know is that he then sets up these situations where he has other people come out. And in one case, I think that in one of the cases, there was at least some testimony that he had actually been there and then takes off on a motorcycle, or somebody takes off on a motorcycle before she arrives. And he says, come on down, 3 minutes. And then all of a sudden, he's gone. So he doesn't have to be there during the transaction. And we might wonder if he's actually the person, the identity of the person setting up these transactions. We might actually wonder if he had knowledge that these transactions were taking place. But what helps cement that and why it's admissible is that he does have knowledge, and we know he has knowledge because he does this on other occasions in the same way with the same informant. And it's not just the girlfriend who may have some sort of problem with him as his girlfriend, it's his mother. So for that reason, it's admissible as a common scheme or plan. The objective here that is different simply from the objective of distributing drugs is to evade detection. And on at least these two occasions, and according to the girlfriend, on other occasions, which was not objected to, what he does normally, although he may not have done it every time, is to have the drugs in a particular place. He's the one who makes the phone call and arranges it, which is what happened in this case. And he has somebody else, usually her, or some, I guess sometimes his mother, come outside and deliver the drugs. And so that tends to show his knowledge, his intent to be the person distributing the drugs, and his identity. So for those reasons, even if it wasn't idiosyncratic, which I would argue that it is, it's not your usual guy standing on the street corner, same person comes or in various places, which the court says, no, that's not proper. This is different. This is phone call, then he leaves and goes and does something else and has somebody else go out and deliver the drugs for him. So the common objective, if you will, is to avoid detection. So for those reasons, I think the court did not err in finding that it fell under the common scheme or plan. Under Rule 2:404, which is that Walker involves, again, joinder of offenses, which is more narrow. But even if it wasn't so idiosyncratic, it fell within one of the other exceptions, and if the court has questions to me as to what specifically, how it does that.
I was trying to figure out why there should be a different standard for joinder versus, I mean, isn't the net effect the same? Now, I understand maybe you could give a cautionary instruction when it's evidence.
Which was done here.
Versus when it's joinder, you have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. You can't have a, I mean, it makes no sense to have a
question. Maybe that's the answer to the question.
That's the only thing I can come up with, but maybe.
But the rule is the rule, right. And the rules are different. And so we have to presume that the legislature knew what they were doing when they wrote the rules. They recently codified these rules of evidence. And I agree, Your Honor.
It always helps to detect if there's some inner logic that drives the rules. And I understand we have to apply them regardless.
But I think you may have, I mean, that certainly is an issue to be considered. I think you may have landed on what they were thinking, although I'm not sure. And I think prior to the rules of evidence being codified, that a lot of people thought that they were more of the same. But now we have the rules. The rules are different. And we have to presume that because they are different, they mean something different. So here the court and the Commonwealth, in its motion to admit this evidence, relied on more than one exception, relied on all those. So those were before the court. And so the court could have found under Perry that right result, wrong reason in this case. There's nothing that precluded that, although it certainly pointed and, I think, emphasized common scheme or plan. If it could have fallen under any of the exceptions properly, then it should have been admitted. And also, along with that, the jury was instructed on all of the exceptions. The jury instruction actually listed all of the potential exceptions that it could be admitted for and cautioned them that they were not to consider it for improper reasons. And, of course, we have to presume that the jury followed their instructions and did not consider this evidence for improper reasons. So for all of those reasons, I would argue that it was properly admitted either under common scheme or plan because this differs from the normal drug case. Also, if it wasn't for that, because it fell under one of the other many other exceptions under Rule 2:404. And finally, that if there was error in this case, that it was harmless error. And Your Honor's point about the conspiracy could, of course, although I didn't argue that because felt that there might have been some issues with the conspiracy, but certainly could fall under the harmless error analysis as well if it was admissible under or could have been considered under the conspiracy. And Also, there was evidence in this case from two separate people that he is the person that's involved in this specific transaction. And it was monitored by police. So I would certainly argue that this was, if any error that occurred in this case, was harmless. Unless the court has further questions for me, I would just ask that you affirm.
Thank you, ma'am. Zilovich?
First on the waiver issue, it wasn't asked, but I'll just address it briefly. The girlfriend testified about things that she had done or things that she had said, but obviously the introduced other act has nothing to do with what the girlfriend said. It had to do with a specific act dealing with his mother. That being said, the trial attorney, I think, had heard the court say, I'm going to introduce evidence of a transaction, and as this court has determined in the last couple of years at least, sometimes you have to balance contemporaneous objections with what you might draw attention to as opposed to what you're trying to do with the larger case. But be it as it may, I don't think it was waived. She raised her objection to other offenses, and frankly, the fact that this girlfriend's talking about other things is an issue that would be subject to cross-examination, which she was. But unfortunately, the mother could not be, because the way that was introduced was through the confidential informant and through Detective Pitts, which I think is another aspect of how this introduction of this other bad act, unadjudicated bad act, was prejudicial to Mr. Bevels in some way. Yes, the standard is different, and obviously this isn't a joinder case where you would hear it de novo, but just because a reasonable juror might believe that it's right, I think this court still, when reviewing what the court did, it has to apply the law. I mean, if it did, we'd have a bunch of unreasonable judges out there who got reversed all the time. And so that I think in this case, the judge had an opportunity, because there was a post-trial motion filed, to say, here's what the Commonwealth told you was going to happen. They previewed it, and he said a common scheme or plan, and they did kind of throw in the garbage language of identity, motive, intent, but again, I would say that the facts of the case certainly didn't bear out any of that. It was all about the common scheme or plan, and so the court had an opportunity to review the transcript, consider argument, perhaps not artfully made, but at least have an opportunity to maybe at that point say, all right, I reverse myself, and we would have it for a new trial without introduction. And he did not do that. So, you know, I would ask the court to at least review his action in light of all the law, not just, I guess, what he presumed to be the facts and the law was presented to him at the time. I would argue this certainly is harmless error. These cases always start with the proposition that we are going to introduce evidence of another crime, but don't consider it as evidence of another crime. Consider it for something else. And just because you ask that to be so doesn't make it so. The jury instruction is very thorough. It's got everything in there. It says identity, evidence of the defendant's knowledge, absence of mistake or accident, evidence of the unique nature of the method of committing the crime, in connection for the offense with which he's trialed, and no other reason. But in these cases, these joinder cases specifically that have come up recently, you know, the issue is, if you're just showing drug transactions, multiple drug transactions that show nothing else than multiple drug transactions, then you're showing propensity and nothing else. And I would argue that the fact of the method of delivery really isn't important. If you want to take the Commonwealth's position that there is a scheme or plan, then at least in that it's Mr. Bevels, a middle person, and I guess the informant, then if there's four of those, how is that really much different than four hand-to-hand transactions with law enforcement? You have to rely on what each offense is supposed to do and then what each offense can show about the other offense. And that, in my mind, that is really the question. What is this case, this November 10th case, the mom case, if you will, showing that helps the finder of fact on November 8th? It shows nothing except that Mr. Bevels on another day sold drugs. And in this case, because, again, I would argue the facts of the case are particularly disturbing, I think, to the finder of fact. They would be. His mother's involved. I think it's also important that the standard the court has to consider is, if you consider all the factors before you remove it, then you have to think about, well, would this substantially influence the jury? If you do strip it away for a second, you have the informant impeached a little bit. She didn't break down on the stand or anything, but there were some issues obviously could be raised in argument. The girlfriend, you could argue, of course, she's caught red-handed. What does she do? She lies. And then basically that he wasn't seen at the scene. Okay, that's the Commonwealth's case. Now, if you toss in, well, we had 2 days later, we had this too, it obviously bolsters the case. It obviously influences the finder of fact. I don't see how it couldn't. And with that in mind, if you can't get to the point where you can't find that it didn't, then you have to consider his due process rights. And I would ask the court again to reverse the decision. Thank you.
Thank you. That completes our docket. Thank you, counsel.